Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, April 29th, 2016. Voting in America's a mess. It's a ball of confusion.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother.
That's Electric Motown, The Temptations, from 1970. There are a lot of great rhymes in there, but they left out the word voter suppression. And we have seen, very graphically this year, the effects of voter suppression schemes embraced by Republicans at the state level all across the country. The long lines in Phoenix. The people in Brooklyn who said, wow, why is my name purged from the list or has been flipped to independent so I can't vote as a Democrat as I always have? And those are just a couple of examples. I mean, it has been a nightmare for many voters across the country. And last week, on the day the prince died, which may explain why we're hearing about it a week later, there was a conference, a hearing on Capitol Hill. And John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan, along with eight other members of Congress, presided over a pretty emotional hearing where people described the new Jim Crow laws that have been forced on over half the states in this country, and the lack of confidence that people have in the credibility of our elections. And to their credit, they heard a number of witnesses who are well-versed on these issues. They talked about the electronic voting machines that were passed out, paid for by the federal government after the stolen election in 2000. And Hank Johnson, the Democrat from Georgia, said, how many of you believe that we should be using a touchscreen voting machine that is 10 years old, operating on year 2000 technology and software, with no security upgrades available for more than a decade? And my friend Bob Fetrakis, the election advocate from Columbus, Ohio, he and Harvey Wasserman have a new book coming out, and we're going to get him on the show here in the next few weeks, I hope. And Bob Fetrakis said the most dangerous thing in our democracy right now is the fact that partisan, for-profit corporations using secret proprietary software provide the voting hardware and the software to register us to vote, count our votes, and report election results. I want to know why these private companies who are not using open-source software are counting our votes, registering our votes, and then doing the central tabulation. And Reverend William Barber, who's been leading the Moral Mondays campaign in North Carolina, he also spoke. And the effort is to pass out some federal dollars to try to secure these unsecured voting machines. I think that's throwing good money after bad. Hand-counted paper ballots. That is the simplest and most credible way to conduct elections. And Willie Barber, who I mentioned, described the avalanche of voter suppression laws unleashed in North Carolina immediately after the Supreme Court gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And as I've heard in previous interviews that I've done with experts in North Carolina, before all these voter suppression tactics were adopted, the Democrats had an advantage of about 300,000 registrants over the Republicans in North Carolina. And these various schemes have essentially erased that margin. And that is the true intent of the voter suppression efforts by the Republicans. But it's lost on the Supreme Court today in what I would infer is a 5-3 decision, but it was an unsigned order, so we don't really know. They left in place the strict voter identification law in Texas. And they even said that they will revisit this issue if the lower court that suspended the law doesn't lift its stay. Stay is a legal term for putting a hold on enforcement of a law. So the Supreme Court is hell-bent on embracing these bogus voter ID laws. Let me find it here. In the hearing on Capitol Hill, there was testimony, here it is, from Joel Siegel, legislative director of the National Election Defense Coalition. He said that a comprehensive investigation of voter impersonation found only 31 credible incidents of so-called voter fraud out of 1 billion ballots cast. 31 out of a billion. So this is clearly a solution in search of a problem that has the benefits of keeping Democrats from voting. And federal courts have repeatedly ruled that the Texas photo ID law is racially discriminatory. But that's not how the white boys on the Supreme Court see it. Now, we know that Justice Ginsburg was not party to this decision, because back in 2014 she dissented in a similar case, saying that the ruling risks denying the right to vote to hundreds of thousands of eligible voters. The law does. And Ginsburg also wrote, a sharply disproportionate percentage of those voters are African American or Hispanic, adding that racial discrimination in elections in Texas is no mere historical artifact. She went on, more than 400,000 eligible voters face round-trip travel times of 3 hours or more to the nearest government office. And you got to pay at least $22 for a birth certificate. And that is a poll tax. You have to pay something in order to be conferred the right to vote, which is something that you get as a citizen. It's not a privilege like driving a car. It's not a regulated matter like owning a gun or now, you know, buying Sudafed at the pharmacy. Those are not accurate comparisons, but that's what they trot out to try to defend these indefensible laws. And so we are seeing this sweep of the pendulum in favor of the powerful, in favor of the moneyed interests, and in favor of the party that Republicans has a higher loyalty factor and voter turnout. And the court is very much a part of this move. The Supreme Court also made a move today that we talked about earlier this week. And what they've done is changed the legal policy that used to say that a federal magistrate could only issue a warrant that would be effective in his or her local jurisdiction. And this came up in the child pornography case involving people who went to a website called Playpen. And many of the people were disguising their identities by using Tor, the encryption tool. And so the FBI inserted malware onto their computers, which revealed their IP addresses. And because the warrant that authorized this action came from a specific court in Virginia, one of the defendants, or the accused in this case, a man from Boston, challenged it, and the courts threw out his indictment. And there are over 1,000 similar cases, apparently, based on this one action at the Playpen website. And despite the fact that civil liberties advocates and even Google say that this is a bad idea, they contend the change will vastly expand the FBI's ability to conduct mass hacks, not only on individual computers, but on computer networks. And it could run afoul of the good old Fourth Amendment, which has been declared obsolete. Ron Wyden, the Democratic senator of Oregon, condemned the rule change as having significant consequences for Americans' privacy. He said he'll introduce legislation to reverse it. And the way this works, the Congress does have the authority to reject this rule change proposed by the Supreme Court. quote, Wyden. Under the proposed rules, the government would now be able to obtain a single warrant to access and search thousands or millions of computers at once, and the vast majority of the affected computers would belong to the victims, not the perpetrators, of a cybercrime. There's a really important story, and Carl Howard, once again, our loyal listener and subscriber from Columbus, Ohio, he linked me up to this story that appears at Counterpunch today under the byline of Robert Jacobs. And Jacobs warns that there is a significant threat of nuclear exposure to those of us who live on the West Coast. And when you hear that, you might immediately say, oh yeah, Fukushima, the meltdown after the tsunami at that multiple nuclear reactor facility in Japan. But Jacobs goes into some detail about the real risk coming from the Hanford nuclear facility in Washington State. It's right on the Columbia River, and it is in the east central part, occupies a huge, huge swath of the state of Washington. At one point, there were a total of 9 nuclear power plants there, and it is now the site of the biggest collection of the most radioactive waste that is being stored in the United States. They have 67 metric tons of plutonium that were manufactured there at Hanford, and it produced a whole lot of waste. And by volume, Hanford is the home to 60% of all of the high-level radioactive waste stored in the United States. Nearly 80% of the Department of Energy's inventory of spent nuclear fuel rods are stored just 400 yards away from the Columbia River. And Jacobs talks about the tank farms at Hanford. There are 177 single and double-shelled waste storage tanks sited at 2 different locations on the Hanford complex. These tanks hold 53 million gallons of the highest level radioactive waste existing in the United States. 67 of those have leaked over 1 million gallons. That's 1/3 of them. In recent years, whistleblowers have come forward from among Hanford employees to describe the flawed design and safety protocols of various operations there. And one of them just got a $4.3 million settlement of his wrongful termination. His name is Walter Tamasatis. Hanford employees who work at the tank farms have suffered serious and unexplained health problems in recent years. The EPA has identified 1,500 or fewer, they say 1,200 to 1,500 specific sites on the Hanford grounds where toxic or radioactive chemicals have been dumped. And Jacobs points out that this has been going on for 70 years. So it is leached into the Columbia River, to the salmon stocks, to some of the grapes that produce some pretty fine wines from the Columbia River Valley, for example. And then there are the downwinders who have suffered greater rates of cancer and some unexplained conditions. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Some days I forget, but not today. Nick Yaksich, Robert Donjakour, and Margaret Anderson, who just took out a new annual subscription. I'd like to thank you for your support of the PBC podcast, and I want to invite others to join in. We've had some new signups recently. I'm gratified by that, but keep them coming. You go to peterbcollins.com, you click the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber, choose the level that fits your budget, and if you choose the $50 annual and you're a new subscriber from the continental U.S., I've got bonus books for you. The titles are displayed on the subscription page at peterbcollins.com. And I also heard from a new listener today. Let me see if I can pull up the email here. Arlene. Arlene checked in and said that she has just started listening recently and that she is an Android phone user. And she wanted me to remind listeners who use the Android platform that you can listen to the Peter B. Collins podcasts either at Stitcher or at Spreaker. Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com. They both support the Android platform. And we've got the iPhone iPad app available for you in the Apple App Store for just $2.99. So grab it, will you? The city of Aleppo is the scene of the breakdown of the troubled ceasefire in Syria. And just in the last 24 hours, at least 60 people have been killed. No, most notably, it's been Russian and Syrian aerial attacks, including these crude barrel bombs that are dropped from helicopters by the Syrian military. And the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Aleppo was targeted not once, but twice. And they used the two-tap approach, which is really, really insidious. And that is, they launch an attack in one area, and then when people rush to help those who've been wounded, try to extricate people who are trapped, that's when they drop a second one. This was depicted not exactly as an intentional move, but as the outcome of the sequence that is shown in the new film called Eye in the Sky, starring Helen Mirren. It's a great film. I got to see it last weekend. I think it's somewhat neutral. It doesn't try to persuade you to take a certain point of view. But it does, I think, accurately depict the collateral damage that occurs from our drone strikes. And in that movie, they depicted what became a two-tap strike on the same location. So today, I had a great in-depth interview with my friend Charles Glass. He's a family friend. He is also a distinguished correspondent who worked for ABC Television for more than 20 years, covering the Middle East, where he started in 1973. So he knows a lot about the region. And he has published a new book called Syria Burning, A Short History of a Catastrophe. And in my conversation, I always learn something when I talk to people who know more than I do. I told him how, you know, I've heard that there are as many as 40 different rebel groups arrayed against the Assad government and the Islamic State in Syria. And here is how he responded, with a number much higher than I ever expected.
2.5 years ago, Jane's Defense, which is a fairly reliable military authority, estimated that there were over 1,500 armed groups fighting in Syria. Some fighting, most, if not all, fighting against the regime, but also fighting against one another. They get support from outside powers, including the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. They also have local support in some places. Some of them are just local warlords. They're a man in a village with 15 gunmen can call himself a liberation force or an Islamic front, and he's one of those 1,500. There is no coherent leadership for the entire opposition to Assad. Assad and the regime are coherent. You know who to talk to with them. With the rebels, you don't know who to talk to. And some of the rebels, the most powerful ones, or Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra, are excluded from the talks in any case. They don't want to take part, and the U.S. and Russia don't want them to take part. Even the U.S. and Russia regard them, as Syria does, as the Syrian government does, as terrorist groups, and they're not part of it. What the Geneva talks are attempting to do is to put the regime together with acceptable opposition. I won't call them moderate, because many of them are seriously jihadi as well, but those who are willing to take part in a transition, have a transition period of 18 months, which would lead to elections and a new government. The problem with that whole idea of transition is that the Assad regime sees the transition as just to another vote of confidence in the Assad regime in the future. And of course, the opposition regards transition as transition to something new, some kind of democratic arrangement in Syria where the Syrian people choose their own leaders and their own system, not have a dictatorship as they have had. Well, really, since 1949, when the CIA overthrew the democratically elected government in Syria in the first place.
You can hear the full conversation with Charles Glass, Charlie. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and Spreaker and Stitcher and TuneIn and iTunes and that German website where you get my podcasts. And the interview with Charles Glass is fascinating. He has a lot to say about what has been going on in Syria. And I do recommend his new book, Syria Burning. It also goes into some of the history that Americans never really have grasped about the long-term U.S. role in the nation of Syria. Now, I mentioned the two-tap attack on the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Aleppo. You may remember last October in Kunduz, Afghanistan, there was a multiple attack on a hospital operated by the same French group, Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières. And today, the Pentagon has said mistakes were made. It was an accident. And that they are lightly punishing 16 people. Some will be suspended, some removed from command, but none will be disciplined in the form of facing criminal charges. And they offer what I consider to be a bullshit explanation. They say that this AC-130 got incorrect coordinates from the source of the attack that was near this hospital, and that they botched their own targeting when they started to bomb. But it's very clear from people on the ground that this is a smokescreen. This is bullshit. General Votel, who conducted the investigation, said it was an extraordinarily intense combat situation, a variety of actions at the same time, and that some people failed to comply with the rules of engagement. But it's not a war crime because the whole thing is just being treated as an accident. And I don't buy it. And I don't think you should either. Meanwhile, there's another bullshit explanation coming from the State of Israel that has conducted a report, an investigation into the March 24th execution of a Palestinian man who was suspected of attacking an Israeli soldier. He had already been wounded and was laying on the ground. His name was Abdul Fattah al-Sharif. And he was executed with a single bullet to the head that was fired by a man who was supposed to be there in a role as a medic. And he should have been checking al-Sharif to see if he was still alive and to see if he needed medical attention. Instead, according to this new report, right before he picked up a gun, he said that the Palestinian needs to die. And after the shooting, he told a commander, he's a terrorist, he needs to die. But then when it was time to write up a report on the incident, he changed his version and said, well, I felt there was a threat to life. He might have had a suicide vest. He may have had a knife. It was right next to him. And that, of course, has all been disproven. But what is bizarre is that the report concludes that it was the twisted ideology of this soldier that drove him to shoot the Palestinian. Now, this is the same twisted ideology that is embraced by Benjamin Netanyahu, most of the Zionist government, and based on the reaction to this incident, a huge majority of the Israeli people. And Max Blumenthal has supplied us a great deal of evidence to support these kinds of attitudes among the Israelis. And the lawyer for the soldier who executed this Palestinian is saying, hey, look, they've already downgraded it from murder to manslaughter. We are sure of his innocence, and we are sure this charge will also disappear. Well, that's what happens all the time, because over the last few years, Israeli investigations, 2,600 of them, into shootings of Palestinians by members of the Israeli Defense Force. Out of 2,600 investigations, only 5% resulted in indictments, and we're only aware of a single case where a soldier was convicted of manslaughter. So, the whitewash continues, and I simply can't accept it. Now, here is a very interesting expression of defense for Sabrina D'Souza. We've been following her case. I interviewed this former CIA officer. You can find it. Just enter Sabrina or Milan into the search window, and you'll find the interview with Sabrina D'Souza, former CIA officer, who was part of a team of CIA undercover agents who was in Milan back in 2003 when we kidnapped Abu Omar, an Egyptian cleric, and Omar was dispatched by the Americans to Egypt, where he was tortured. And despite all that, Abu Omar is coming to the defense of Sabrina D'Souza. And D'Souza, who was caught in Portugal last year, is scheduled to be deported to Italy to face a 4-year sentence. She was convicted in absentia for her role in that kidnapping in 2003. But Abu Omar says Sabrina and the others who were convicted are scapegoats. The U.S. administration sacrificed them. All of those higher up in the hierarchy are enjoying their immunity. These people higher up, without doubt, they should be convicted in this case. They should face trial. Well, he's a pretty compassionate individual to be able to forgive one of the people who schemed to kidnap and deliver him for torture. He went on to say, well, she's 60 years old. If media reports are right, she and the people who kidnapped me were the reason why I left my job in Italy, and a lot of trouble to me and my family happened because of it. They are the reason behind my physical disabilities now. The Italian prosecution actually accused her of this. But whatever her involvement, she's threatened to be sentenced between 4 and 6 years, and I don't wish that for her. I've been in prison before, and I don't wish for the same to happen to her, either as a friend or foe, especially because she's a woman. And D'Souza responded, saying, Abu Omar also recognizes that my imprisonment will not result in real accountability for what he went through in Egypt. And the U.S. intervened with the Italians to win pardons for the two top dogs who presided over this case, but left the underlings to twist in the wind. You remember the story of Sergeant Charles Martland, a Special Forces Green Beret operator, who was in Afghanistan, and he beat up an Afghan militia commander named Abdul Rahman in 2011. After Rahman had abducted a boy and kept him chained to his bed as a sex slave. Martland told officers that he simply felt that he could no more, he could not morally stand by and allow the Afghan local police to commit atrocities. So he beat the crap out of this guy. And our military, began proceedings against Sergeant Maitland. Well, it's been a long road for him, but he has finally found a ruling that will permit him to stay in the military, and the efforts to discharge him are being suspended. Oh, yeah, we got a presidential race here in the United States, don't we? New poll from USA Today Suffolk University says that Donald Trump will beat Hillary Clinton by 2 points, a 45-43 margin. Meanwhile, the latest CBS News New York Times poll in matchups with the candidates shows that Hillary Clinton ties, I believe it's a tie, I don't have it right in front of me, Donald Trump. But Bernie Sanders beats Trump and his bad hair comb over by 15 points. Now, these are snapshots that are very current. And Hillary supporters are suffering from denial and arrogance, in my opinion, because many of them believe now that they've got the nomination wrapped up, they can ignore Bernie Sanders and the people who supported him in the primaries, and they're promising to take a hard line in any negotiations over what Hillary Clinton will do to win an endorsement from Bernie Sanders. And the conservative Dems are saying that, oh, you know, he's already pushed her too far to the left. It might endanger a victory in November because the further you go to the left or right, the further you frustrate independents. But this is just more bullshit. Because independents support Bernie Sanders much more than Hillary Clinton when you lift the controls, the walls of party primaries, closed primaries. And I am just amazed at how many people who support Hillary Clinton are in some sort of a mental bubble where they cannot see her vulnerabilities, her weaknesses, her high negatives, and the prospect that she could be indicted or otherwise embarrassed by the investigation into her email. And that people are willing to take the risk on Hillary with these polls and those risks. I can't explain it. And speaking of Trump and the Republicans, they're all in California this weekend. There is a state Republican Party convention near the San Francisco airport here in the Bay Area. Everybody's speaking, Trump, Kasich, Cruz. And, you know, I don't expect a whole lot of news to come from it. There was a Trump rally in Southern California last night. Violence and broken windows on police cars were reported. I'm not sure who's responsible for that. But one of the stories surfacing is that two operatives, political consultants here in California, who are running campaigns for Trump and Cruz, worked as paid advisors to a campaign in Guatemala in 2011. The consultants are Tim Clark and Ron Nehring. Tim Clark has been hired by the Trump campaign, and as of yesterday, he's never met or communicated directly with Donald Trump. But Clark is running the delegate hunt and the operations here in California, and Ron Nehring, N-E-H-R-I-N-G, is working for Ted Cruz. But if you go back to 2011, they were hired by American corporate interests who they don't identify to be advisors to Manuel Baldizón, a right-wing populist and business tycoon who promised, if he were elected, to broadcast the executions of criminals on TV in Guatemala. And as a candidate, he also said that he promised, it's described that he promised everything to everybody and promised to get the country's national soccer team into the World Cup. Now, those are campaign promises, aren't they? And here's an item that I didn't have time for yesterday. The chancellor of the University of California at Davis is under siege. Her name is Linda Katehi. And over time, it's been slow dripping out. It was exposed that she accepted fees to advise a for-profit university called DeVry. She accepted money that's the equivalent of her annual salary of about $400,000 to be an advisor to the textbook company John Wiley & Sons, which appears to be a conflict of interest given that she presides over a university that buys textbooks. Now we've learned that she has her daughter on the payroll at UC Davis and even promoted her to a junior chancellor. What's her exact title here? Assistant Vice Chancellor, where they pay her $130,000 a year. And the son of the chancellor, whose name is Eric Sragunas, is a paid researcher, and he was improperly placed under the supervision of that wife. Now, in addition, Katehi's husband is a chemical engineering professor, and he was hired by faculty, so he's not a part of this scandal. But what has also surfaced is that Linda Katehi authorized the payment of $175,000 to consultants who promised to scrub the internet of references to the pepper spray scandal that she presided over in 2011 when Occupy protesters who refused to move were blasted right in the face with pepper spray in high volumes. So she's been suspended by the Uber chancellor of the California university system. And she will be investigated, but if she's smart, she will resign immediately. And newspaper editorials and some political leaders here are calling for that already. And yesterday I mentioned that Prince may have died because of an addiction to prescription painkillers. Percocet was described. And I got what appears to be an angry response from Natalie Reel, a longtime loyal listener. She says, "Honestly, Peter, are you sitting in judgment? Why are opioids vilified? Because a handful of people have killed themselves with those drugs? Prescription painkillers," she says, "are in heavy usage because millions of people do live in chronic pain. Why deny pain relief to these millions? Is addiction really such a bad thing? Why does society believe addiction is a bad thing? Because it prevents people from being upstanding and productive citizens like taxpayers? You may blame doctors and Big Pharma for making the drugs available, but perhaps you should also question, why is there so much chronic pain? Why aren't the criminal cartels of Big Pharma, their universities for hire, CDC, FDA, researching cures to chronic pain rather than just treating the symptoms? Why is there so much chronic disease? You can even ask if big medicine has created diseases, accidentally or on purpose. And in a postscript, she says, as you know, for many, cannabis provides partial and full relief from pain. But for those who only get partial relief, the availability of an opioid is a good thing. Now, my comments, at least as I intended them, Natalie, were to ask people not to demonize Prince. Not to treat him as just another rock star druggie who spun out of control. But if indeed it's shown that, you know, the opioids played a role in his death, my approach is his sympathy and compassion. I am critical of the drug companies for pushing out so many addictive drugs without warning people properly and providing ways for them to deal with the dependency that often develops. And I'm not against pain relief in any way, shape, or form. I recognize that chronic pain is very serious for people who live with it, and I feel very fortunate that I'm not one of them. And so, Natalie, I hope you have heard me, and I hope that my comments were not wrong in their tone or perhaps, you know, inviting misinterpretation. But my approach is to deal with this as a medical issue, not as a criminal matter. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to say. That's my News and Comment for today. Thanks for listening. I always welcome your comments. The email is peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you.